The Spiritual Brew Pub Podcast will help you navigate spiritually after or during a belief shift, deconstruction, or crisis of faith. Not to try to convert you to a particular destination, but give you the resources you need to evaluate your future belief or unbelief and help you follow the religious historical evidence wherever it leads. I'm your host, Michael Camp, a recovering conservative evangelical, the operative word being recovering, sharing my journey and helping others rebuild faith or a reasoned philosophy of life. So grab your brew of choice and learn how fact-based history helps us both critique and rethink faith. Why do we call it a brew pub? Because we like to hang out in them, at least metaphorically. A pub is a great place to let your hair down, share your true thoughts about your journey, and discuss things with an open mind in a non-judgmental environment. Welcome, everyone, to the number 4 episode of the Spiritual Brew Pub Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Camp, and today we are going to finish up the topic of 12 fake claims of Western Christianity. We've dealt with the first 6, and we're going to go through number 7 through 12. But before I get into that, I want to put this topic in context. When I left the evangelical movement about 15 years ago, I was on the tail end of a faith crisis. I had just come back from Africa as a missionary, and I had some serious depression and anxiety issues going on that were linked to that experience. But I was really kind of fed up with the way that most churches that I was attending and in the missionary movement that I was a part of was misrepresenting Jesus, the way I would put it, misrepresenting what I thought the Bible was teaching. And also some churches were, I was recognizing how some churches were actually becoming spiritually abusive to their members, and also becoming far too politically conservative for my liking. So I started to do some research on my own and to discover for myself what was really true behind the scenes about what we were taught in a lot of these contexts. Because mostly the answers I was getting when I was doing my, when I was asking questions within the evangelical movement were pat answers. They really weren't satisfying me intellectually or spiritually. They started with questions like, why do we believe the Bible is infallible? I mean, I see contradictions in there. Questions about, are people really going to hell because they don't accept Christ? Why is all we have all this obsession about the end times? It doesn't seem like the Bible's really talking about the 21st century or the 20th century. And then they progressed to other questions like, why can't practicing gays and lesbians be accepted in the church and be considered true Christians and things like that? So this research, what it entailed was largely looking at the New Testament more carefully, looking at the original language and meaning, looking at the history of early Christian history and the history of the Reformation. And things like how was the Bible compiled, and the history of how we got our church structure, institutions, and beliefs about what church is. So we're going to talk about some of the discoveries that I made today in this second part of this episode, the fake claims, numbers 7 through 12. Okay, number 7 fake claim is what I call the substitutionary atonement scam. Now, this has to do with what people would tell you or preachers would say, what is the meaning of the cross, of Jesus' death on the cross? And it kind of goes something like this. God's really angry at humanity's sin. You are a depraved individual. You are destined to be judged by God and found guilty and going to hell because of your sin. And the only way that you can get out of it is that Jesus has come and taken your place on the cross. He's been your substitute. So God punishes the sins of humanity through the sacrifice of Jesus. And then finally, when you accept that sacrifice, then finally God is appeased. His anger is appeased. His demands of justice are done. And then he can finally forgive you. And then it kind of goes from there. But so as I did my study into Christian history, what I discovered is that the early Christians did not believe this. They didn't believe that Jesus' death on the cross was a substitute for the judgment of humanity's sin. They did not believe that God could redeem humanity only if Jesus took this punishment in their place. They didn't believe that only if someone formally accepted this saving act by receiving, you know, they used to say, receive Jesus as your Lord and Savior. They didn't believe only if that happened would a person be forgiven. They didn't believe that the righteous God, the Son, had to save us from the angry God, the Father. So in other words, this way of looking at the cross is called the penal substitutionary atonement theory. And it's taught by most conservative Christians today. But it was completely foreign to the earliest followers of Christ. When you look at history, it tells us that this idea emerged slowly and really started in the 11th century by a guy named Anselm, an archbishop in the Catholic Church. And it didn't really mature until its modern form, until the Reformation, and in particular through John Calvin, one of the reformers. So another interesting thing I discovered was that Eastern Orthodox theology sees the cross completely differently. The meaning of the cross, I should say. For them, it's a transformative phenomenon, not a legal requirement, as if God can't forgive unless someone is punished. Jesus' death by crucifixion was not a way to appease God's sense of righteousness, but rather more like a historical exhibition of a non-sacrificial way of ending sacrifice. I won't get into the details of that, but, you know, it's kind of like Jesus, despite being scapegoated by an angry mob, some corrupt Jewish leaders, and the Romans, who couldn't bring themselves to stand up for an innocent man, basically, despite all that and the torturous, terrible death that he endured, he chose to forgive, to not retaliate. And that's kind of like the core of the message of the cross, not as some kind of a legal requirement that God had to happen before he could forgive people. So that kind of an idea, to me, was much more transformative, much more satisfying, because the other way just didn't make sense. The way it was described in churches, it seems like God is angry, this angry God who can't even accept you the way you are until something just so drastic happens. But the other way of looking at it is that, you know, even when Jesus forgives his most violent enemies, there is no reason to continue this sacrificial religion. Jesus said in the New Testament, "Father, forgive them," when he was on the cross, enduring this torture, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He didn't say, "Father, forgive them, now that I've taken the punishment that they deserve." So through history, the Western Church has, since Anselm and Calvin and on into today, has largely perpetuated a sacrificial or payment view of the cross. Marcus Borg names it a deeply destructive notion. It's like God becomes vindictive. He can't forgive unless there is a human sacrifice. And it continues a religious tendency to see salvation as what Michael Harden calls an economy of exchange. And actually, that's one of the fake claims that we're going to talk about a little bit. But that's the notion that you're saved or you're healed or you're delivered or you're helped or whatever, only if something is given in exchange. So that is the number seven scam, the substitutionary atonement scam. Oh, by the way, as I talk about each one of these fake claims, I'll give you some suggestions for some books or sources that where I got some of this information. One of them is for the number seven one is the Original Christian Gospel. It's an article or booklet by James Bernstein, an Eastern Orthodox priest. Has a very good article about the history of how people looked upon salvation from the very original movement until modern notions today. Another book is called Saved by Sacrifice by Mark Heim. So let's move on to the number eight fake claim. And this is what I call the end times fake claim or scam. And a couple books that you might, I would cite as sources for this one would be one of them was written years ago, but it was actually a very good book. It's called Last Days Madness by Gary DeMar. And Gary DeMar is actually, ironically, a conservative Christian, and I would probably disagree with him on almost everything else he wrote. But this book, he actually does a very good job to expose why it's just kind of a fallacy to believe that we are in the end times today. N.T. Wright also has a lot of good material on the end times. And also, a first century historian named Josephus wrote a book called The Jewish Wars. That's a very old, ancient document, but it's readily available. You can read it, and it goes into what happened in the first century. So those are some of my sources for this one. So the bottom line for this is when you really look under the hood and look at the New Testament writings about what Jesus called the end of the age, and you look at the history of the first century, you discover that Jesus did not believe or teach that he would return to earth in judgment thousands of years in the future to set up his kingdom. He actually taught that the kingdom of God, or more accurately, the reign of God, was already in our midst and in fact was within us. Nor did he teach that he would physically return within the lifetime of his followers. Jesus used very common cosmic imagery, language from that the Jewish prophets often used to describe the end of the Jewish sacrificial age, you know, the end of the temple Judaism. You know, he used the phrase end of the age, not the end of the world. He wasn't speaking about the end of the world, but rather the end of an era. Some of that example, his language, like when he said the coming of the Son of Man, this was not some far-off future primitive form of space travel he was talking about, or a rapture of believers, but it was a statement that that he and his message of peace would be vindicated. You can see some of this cosmic imagery in the Old Testament. For example, Isaiah at one time said, God will come to Egypt in the clouds. This was the kind of language they used about the some kind of a geopolitical, social, religious change that was coming to the Jewish people. And so they would use this kind of language, but it wasn't talking about the end of the world. It was just talking about the end of an era that was ending, and God was doing something different, or something different was coming on the people. So, you know, this notion that I'm expounding here probably flies in the face of what many you were taught, or most of us were taught in churches, you know, Jesus is coming soon, and et cetera, et cetera. We could be in the end times. There's been a lot of books written about it. Most popular these days was the Left Behind series, and even a movie that Nicolas Cage starred in about being left behind in the last days, and and if it happened today, what would it be like, and so forth. But the one of the things is that this is kind of read in. This all this idea is bred into the New Testament. It's not really derived from a fair reading of the New Testament. There's also mistranslated words in the New Testament. You know, when it says go into all the world and preach the gospel, and then the end will come, and so people interpret that as, the whole gospel has to reach the ends of the earth before Jesus comes back. Well, Jesus was talking about going into the Greek word was the region or the political area where you live. It was really talking about the Roman world. It wasn't talking about the whole world. And so actually the first followers of Jesus did go into all of the Roman world pretty much. And then something happened that notated the end of the era. And that something was, of course, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple way of temple and the way of that whole way of Jewish religion that centered around the temple. Sometimes people who preach the last days actually completely ignore the plain words of Jesus himself. Like, for example, when he described what would happen in this tribulation period and then the end when Jerusalem would be destroyed, he said, "This generation shall not pass away until all these things take place." So he wasn't talking, he was saying it would all happen within one generation. Now, what were these things that he was talking about? Well, they were the catastrophic events, both before and during the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, what the New Testament calls the tribulation at the end of the age. And it's very interesting. The other part about this is that if you looked at that book I mentioned, The Jewish Wars by Josephus, a first century historian, he actually goes into fairly good detail of what happened in 70 AD, or I should say the Jewish revolt. What historians call the Jewish revolt occurred between 66 and 73 AD. And this is what Jesus was talking about. It was a revolt by the Jews that culminated in the middle of that period in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And Josephus records this, and he also, it's fascinating to read how all the other events kind of surrounding this dovetail with many of the sayings of Jesus. And notice that revolt lasted 7 years, and that was what the tribulation was supposed to be in Revelation. But, you know, the bottom line is that a fair reading of the New Testament and taking into account the history of the first century, these things that were mentioned were talking about things happening in the first century. They weren't talking about things that would happen thousands of years in the future. Even the book of Revelation, go read the very first verse of the book. It says, this is going to tell you about things that will soon take place. Wasn't talking about far in the future. So that's the end time scam. There's actually a lot of material on this as well. And I've just given you a few resources that I've found helpful. Okay, let's move on. The number 9 scam or fake claim of Western Christianity is what I call the misogyny scam. So it's not a secret that there's a deep prejudice against women in Western Christianity. Women can't become pastors. They are considered more fundamentalist churches. They're supposed to submit to men and their husbands, etc. They really only have kind of support roles. Evangelicalism calls this complementarianism, which is a way of basically saying that God accepts everyone as equals, but not the roles that they play. Men can only be pastors and leaders and have authority in the church. Women can't. they play a more supportive role. So this is kind of the narrative that was spouted out there, and certainly was in the churches that I went to. Never went to a church where the woman could be a pastor. And so what I discovered in my research was the history of the New Testament, of the early Christian era, and the New Testament really turns this notion on its head. History is full of solid evidence of, for example, men changing the translations of Greek terms so that they would insert their bias against women. And I'll give you some examples. One of the books, the main book I'd like to cite as the resource for this one is called The Source New Testament. It's by Dr. Ann Nyland. And it's not a typical translation of the Bible, of the New Testament. It's got a lot of notes about why she translated certain things a certain way, and a lot of notes about the historical context of the New Testament. It's called The Source by Dr. Ann Nyland. You could look it up and Google it and go on Amazon and find it. But basically what this reveals is that how the New Testament was mistranslated in certain areas, in this case involving women. One example would be, there's a woman in the book of Romans that Paul cites named Junia, and she was called worthy and honorable among the apostles. She was basically called an apostle by Paul. One of the early church fathers, I forgot the one, offhand, but cited her once and said, oh, what an amazing woman she must have been to be cited as an apostle by Paul. And but in the English translations of the New Testament, her name was actually changed to a male form for centuries, a male form being like Junius instead of Junia. And so that's one example of people actually changing the Bible so that it would reflect their own bias against women. Another one would be, Paul also mentions a woman named Phoebe in the book of Romans, and at one point she is actually, the text says that Paul calls her a presiding officer at a local gathering. The Greek is actually talking about, the word is actually a word that denotes someone of a chief rank who is a leader or a protector. And all the New Testament translations translated as something like a helper. Oh, she was a great helper. Well, the Greek word is actually means a leader of the gathering. So what the equivalent of what we might call a pastor. So that's another example of the bias of translators, and that's why this Source New Testament is a really good resource. It goes into why something is mistranslated and what the more accurate translation is. And in this case, Phoebe was a leader or a pastor of a local gathering. Another really fascinating one is in 1 Corinthians. Paul supposedly teaches that women should be silent in the churches, which is actually a direct contradiction to what he says in other passages. But this has actually been revealed as to be most likely a scam, because there are two verses that were inserted, and in some copies of the New Testament, they were inserted in one place, and some copies they were inserted in another place. They show up in two different areas of that chapter, and even some leading evangelical scholars have put out this case. Most biblical scholars see this pretty clearly, and they don't have a problem with it, because copyists over the years made some insertions or made some changes. why they were translating and copying the scriptures. But of course, most evangelicals, that just doesn't fly very well. But even Gordon Fee and F.F. Bruce have put out this case in their writings. Gordon Fee did a commentary on 1 Corinthians years ago that went totally below the radar most evangelicals. But basically, that little passage that says, "A woman should be silent in churches," that's not in the original letter that Paul wrote. So those are some of the examples of why this notion that women can't be leaders, that they should, have a supportive role, so forth, does not line up with history and the original Greek words and meaning behind Paul's teaching. So that's the number one scam, and we'll move on here. I mean number nine scam there, sorry. So the number 10 scam is what I call the morality scam. Now, the book I want to cite for you on this one is called The Subversion of Christianity by Jacques Ellul, a French theologian. This is a very good book. It was originally written in French and translated in English, so it's a little bit awkward in the translation, but it's not a bad book, and it's an excellent book. I mean, but it's not a bad translation. But this is the Jacques Ellul. What he does is basically in that book, he talks about a lot of things about why Western Christianity is really a real Christianity or real teachings of Christ have been subverted, and Christianity is being misrepresented, or Christ is being misrepresented in most of Western Christianity. And basically, this is the notion that, the Bible is kind of like this, this moral code that we follow. And Jacques Ellul reminds us that actually, in Jesus' teachings and even Paul's teachings, one of the main points that he makes is that the law, the way that God spells out a law in the Old Testament and says, do this, don't do that, do this, it just doesn't work. That's why Jesus and Paul start talking about love being the fulfillment of the law. Jesus said that love God and love your neighbor sums up the law and the prophets. And so they're constantly going back and saying, you really can't live a good life by always just nitpicking on the law, because there's always exceptions to the law. There's always, we don't know what people are. Law can't predict every possible scenario. It can't know every person's inner motivation or adapt to the ever-changing requirements of loving people in different historical contexts. So, this will be the quote of the podcast. Maybe there'll be another one too, but this will be a good one to have. This is what Ellul says: God's revelation has absolutely nothing to do with morality. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He goes on to say, the revelation of God in Jesus is against morality. So basically he's saying the whole point of Jesus and Paul's teachings is that the will of God, what God wants, or the rationality of God, can never be fixed in a set of commandments or morals. It really must be born in someone's heart. I mean, it starts in the heart. And so this is why Jesus attacked the most legalistic moralists of his day, the Pharisees, because they were so legalistic about everything, and everything had to be just right and could never have exceptions. And they criticized him for working on the Sabbath. But this is why Jesus did stuff on the Sabbath to help people, because that was the right thing to do. That's why he declared all foods clean in the book of Mark, because it's ridiculous to have a system, a moral code that says certain foods are clean and certain foods aren't. And this is, Paul says things like, everything is lawful for those who follow the way of love. What counts is not to be moral, but to be loving. If you just engage in loving behavior or live a life of love, that fulfills any commandments of the law. Now, here's another quote by Elul. He says, this freedom, he's talking about the freedom that you have in following Jesus' teachings. This freedom does not mean doing anything at all. It is the freedom of love. Love which cannot be regulated, categorized, or analyzed into principles or commandments. This takes the place of law. The relationship to others is not one of duty, but of love. So if you don't get this point, you'll do things like, for example, this is why the evangelical church basically rejects gays and lesbians, the LGBT community, because they see some kind of a law or code against homosexuality in the only five or six passages where it's mentioned. They make it into a rule, a law, and they can't budge because that's the way they view the Bible. Whereas when you realize that there really is no moral code, it's only a love code, then you realize that what really counts is not, you know, following everything to the letter, but just loving people. So if the LGBT community is a community, people within that community are loving people and they embrace the love ethic of Jesus, they're perfectly welcome in the church or to be a Christian. That's the conclusion that you would come if you realize that there is no real moral code in the Bible. There is only a love code. So, like anything in life, sexual orientations and sexual behaviors, they cannot be condemned by religious taboos. The only way they are constrained is by love. As long as anyone, whether they're heterosexual or someone in the LGBT community, as long as anyone commits to living a life of love, in other words, not to harm others by their behavior, they are equals in a community of faith. Okay, that was number 10. Before we go on to number 11, very briefly, I want to let you know that the next podcast, I'm going to be interviewing someone. I'll be doing my first interview. Very excited about that. Her name is Barbara Simons. She wrote a book called Escaping Christianity and Finding Christ. So we're going to have an interesting conversation with her. She's got an amazing story to tell. And I think we have some common ground, have some common experiences that we'll talk about. And I think she would be really good, give some really good life experiences from herself coming out of fundamentalism and where she's found a home. Okay, the next one is what I call the scam of spiritual exchange or an economy of exchange. And this is the notion, and the writings or books that I would cite would be Michael Harden's got a great book called The Jesus-Driven Life, Reconnecting Humanity with Jesus. He talks about some of this, and he cites a lot of Rene Girard's work. Rene Girard talks about this as well. And this is the notion that, you know, there's some kind of an economy of exchange set up in the spiritual world. And if you want God to do something for you, you basically have to make an exchange. You have to pray, you have to accept Christ, you have to, you know, do this, do that, go to church, obey the Bible. You'll be, you know, in the Old Testament, it was kind of thrown out there as, you know, you obey God and everything will go great. You don't obey God, you're going to be punished and everything's going to go terrible. So, But it's this notion that you have to tap into God. Some kind of an exchange has to take place. You've obeyed him, so now things will work out. You've done something, so now things will work out. You haven't done it, so that things won't work out. And when I was in the evangelical movement, I was in a lot of charismatic churches, and they had this notion that God would bring revival to the world or to your country from time to time, and we were obligated to pray for revival, and so that was a big deal. You know, it's like, oh, you know, we expect God to, we believe God's going to bring a revival. So people would pray for it, and you'd read material about revivals in the past. What happened is that you get in this mindset that, God can't do anything or doesn't really move unless you do something. You pray harder, you fast. They would cite Bible verses why this was the case, and et cetera, et cetera. I once heard a fundamentalist leader say that God doesn't do anything unless prompted by our prayers. So, with that kind of a notion, it's kind of like thinking to yourself, oh, is that the way God is? And is that the way you are with your children? Do you not do anything for your children unless they ask for something? You know, if they ask for something, you would respond to them. But what about when they don't ask for something? They don't know what to ask for. They don't. They need something, and you know, a loving parent is going to provide for them and do things for them, whether they ask or not. So the scam is that actually Jesus taught the exact opposite. He said that God knows what you need before you ask him. He basically told people, hey, don't pray publicly. People pray publicly to kind of show off in the streets or in the synagogues and the churches. But just pray, go into your room, pray privately. He actually taught a very short prayer as a way to pray. And use very few words. And don't be like the pagans or the people who think that they're going to be heard more if they pray more, if they pray publicly, or if they, they go on and on and on. God already knows what you need. Access is already there. As far as fasting goes, Jesus basically said, don't draw attention to it. If you do fast, don't draw attention to it. So anyways, these are some of the things that I found in my experience in the evangelical movement that I would call an economy of an exchange. And I don't see that in when I look carefully at Christ's teachings, that there is such a thing as an economy of exchange. God, he doesn't need his arm twisted to act. So the number 12 scam or fake claim is what I call the scam of justifying war and violence. And when I first became serious about following Christ way back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I read the New Testament throughout in one, pretty much almost in one sitting, I was really impacted by one amazing thing, and that was I actually figured if I'm going to be a Christian, I must be a pacifist. Because to me, it was very clear that Jesus taught his followers, to love their enemies, not to resist an evil person or evil movement or conquest with violence. He exemplified nonviolence resistance. And as Paul put it, don't overcome evil with more evil. Don't overcome violence with more violence, but overcome evil with good. And so I thought this was one of the most revolutionary messages in the world. This whole notion of loving your enemies and trying to befriend them, actually, and show them, just like God actually loves everyone, you love everyone, and don't perpetuate a cycle of violence or a cycle of revenge and so forth, or hatred. So to me, that just translated into man, if there was ever a war, I guess I'd have to be a conscientious objector. I'd have to be a pacifist as a Christian. So then I went into the evangelical church and, you know, got involved. And then I found out that actually there were no pacifists in the evangelical church. I couldn't find one. I talked to people, asked questions. I was at La Brie Fellowship once in Switzerland. That's kind of like a spiritual retreat that Francis Schaeffer set up. And I visited there once, and that was one of my big questions. Why aren't we pacifists? And they started telling me about the just war theory. And other people told me about this. And, you know, they say, oh, well, even read this. Even C.S. Lewis agrees with this. You know, like in World War II, we had to fight the Nazis and so forth and so on. And I found out, I discovered that in most churches, the military was really honored and rightly so in many ways, but in a way that really disturbed me. There was never any question about being involved in the military. If you were someone said, "Oh, I'm gonna join the military," they were encouraged. People would say, "Oh yeah, I was in the service," and so forth, and it was all just this great thing. No one ever questioned anything. And I found that to be quite strange because in my, you know, we had just come out of the Vietnam War when I first became an evangelical and, you know, just a few years before. And that was talking about a questionable war. I find that as I look back on it and read history on it, it was obviously a misguided and ill-conceived war. And the evangelical church, you know, never a peep about this whole issue about whether we should be involved in the military complex of war, and even though people said, oh yeah, there's a just war theory, no one ever said, well, does this war apply? Have we done it? No one ever talked like that. It was just complete acceptance of whatever our country was doing as far as being involved in wars and the military. So what's really fascinating is that about this is when you go back and you look at history of the earliest church, earliest first century Christianity, and on up to the third and fourth century, and the historical facts are quite amazing. For at least the first two centuries of the faith, followers of Jesus were taught to disavow military service. The books that I'm going to tell you as resources for this one, there's one called The Underground Church by Robin Myers, and Michael Harden has some good material on this, and I think I've got a quote for you from him, and even Rene Girard, like I mentioned, he's got some really good things to say about this topic as well. So the point is that if you look at first century, early Christian history, it was exceedingly rare, if not unknown, for Christians to be in the military. And I'm going to give you some quotes from Michael Harden's book, Jesus Driven Life, which the subtitle is Jesus Driven Life. Here are some quotes. One simply never finds evidence that Christians justified military service as a possibility. So there's 200 years of basically Christian pacifists, early church fathers, Tertullian, Cyprian, Clement of Alexandria, Origen, and some guy, I can't even pronounce his name. Basically, when you look at these guys, there's a common opinion that violent retaliation was foreign to the spirit of the gospel. Oh, actually, that was part of Michael Harden's quote, I see. Even into the early 4th century, another someone called this guy named Eusebius, they call him the first Christian historian. He avowed, disavowed military service, and he was a pacifist until later on when he was influenced by Constantine. So what we find when we look at history is that all the way up until the 4th century, Christians were pacifists. They were disavowed military service, and it didn't come about until Constantine became emperor before there was a change and there was a switch. There was a switch from nonviolent and violence and peace to justifying violence in contexts. So, and Robin Myers calls this the Great Reversal. Something happened at that time. Things changed, and the Emperor Constantine, when he became supposedly a Christian, he began to make these changes and arguments that there is a time to justify war, because that was his philosophy. He did not really, in my mind, become a real convert to Christ. He was kind of using Christianity to unify the empire, because they're for various reasons. So what's really ironic about this part of history is that Constantine became emperor, changed so much in Christianity. That's a whole nother topic. It's amazing. And stopped the persecution of Christians by the empire. But ironically, what happened is that eventually the church began persecuting itself. So persecution really didn't stop. It just got transferred over into the Christian church. And that's a very fascinating study. And here's another quote from Michael Harden in that same book. This is just blows your mind, but I think it stacks up to a study of history. In the 100 years following the ascension of Constantine, more Christians died at the hands of Christians than had died the previous 250 years at the hands of the Roman Empire. So that's just an amazing to think about that. So after Constantine, Augustine, who was later in the 4th century, he began to influence the church to justify coercion using violence, to say that was justified. And, you know, to get a confession to help people repent. And it was a theology that justified persecution and later inquisitions and burnings at the stake and all that stuff that was going on later on down through the centuries. So, and finally, Augustine also laid the foundation of what we now call the just war theory. Which is a way of that the church justified violence. So that's the very last scam number 12, there really is no, when you look at church history, there really is no way of justifying our Christians' involvement in war and violence, or at least we can have a debate about it, but it's not a however you see it and debate it. You can't base it on what the Christians did in the first three or four centuries. They were pacifists. So that ends this episode. Thank you for listening, and remind you that the next episode we're going to have a interview with Barbara Simons, the author of Escaping Christianity, Finding Christ. She's got an amazing story, and we'll discuss some ideas around that. So we look forward to seeing you next time, and have a good one.
The Spiritual Brewpub Podcast will help you navigate spiritually after or during a belief shift, deconstruction, or crisis of faith. Not to try to convert you to a particular destination, but give you the resources you need to evaluate your future belief or unbelief and help you follow the religious historical evidence wherever it leads. I'm your host, Michael Camp, a recovering conservative evangelical, the operative word being recovering, sharing my journey and helping others rebuild faith or a reasoned philosophy of life. So grab your brew of choice and learn how fact-based history helps us both critique and rethink faith. Why do we call it a brew pub? Because we like to hang out in them, at least metaphorically. A pub is a great place to let your hair down, share your true thoughts about your journey, and discuss things with an open mind in a non-judgmental environment.